Welcome to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan, your host, and I thank you so much for joining us on the program today. It is a very special program we have for you today, and we hope that you'll stay with us as we talk dolphin here on Tell Me Your Story. What is the relationship between them and us, and can we actually communicate with them? And this particular piece is dedicated to a connection.
On a dream on a crystal clear ocean, to ride on the crest of a wild raging storm, to work in the service of life and the living, in search of the answers to questions unknown, to be part of the movement, part of the growing, part of beginning to understand.
Those aren't the sounds of dolphins, and that was John Denver's Calypso. Those are the sounds of whales. More than close cousins, I suppose. They all share the same water. And we have with us in studio today a woman is going to share with us the concept of dolphin communication. And I want to welcome Dove Jones to our program today. Thank you so much for joining us in studio.
Thank you, Richard, for having me.
It's a joy to have you in the program today, because one of the aspects of this program in terms of new paradigms for a new world and looking for those different choices that we don't even know exist, and then learning about them and what they are all about in terms of moving from a place of survival mode to a place of thriving. I think on one of the programs I used survival, thrivable, whatever mode. We're trying to make this a better place for all of us, not just the humans, but all the species that exist on the planet. And quite honestly, from my perspective, we're making a mess of it, and it's not getting better unless you see things that we don't see. And that's what we want to talk about. In addition to your ability, or what you talk about in your book, you have a book called I Am Dolphin.
That book is coming out hopefully in the next few months. At least I might do a part one, part two, part three series of that, so I can get the initial scientific evidence out behind holographic communication, which is really dolphin talk. It's what all animals are communicating on, including humans, because we're a part of the animal kingdom. Mm-hmm. Most people have forgotten that.
Yeah.
So, and we're connected into the almost the web of life, really.
Yeah.
So starting from the way we were born in our aquatic connection, the womb. A beautiful thing about our womb connection and that essential piece to the puzzle of why we matter in life is that, do you know what dolphin means?
No.
And
I didn't know it was a... I should know that every word has some kind of meaning regardless of what language, what...
Like Latin and Greek.
Yeah.
It means womb. So dolphin means womb because back in the Greek time, besides revering dolphins, they esteemed them as much as a human being. So if any kind of ill will or hurt came to a dolphin, they considered that if you hurt a dolphin, basically that would be considered to like murdering a human.
Mm-hmm.
With the same kind of consequences. So they believe that they called Delphic, dolphin, womb, because of the similarities that we share in the womb, that we both come from the womb. And that connection goes down to our cells. So it's actually a DNA connection.
Mm-hmm.
That we're connected to all of life through water, and then it goes up into telecommunication. On the radio show that I was with you before, earlier in the week with Ed Giron, I spoke about the dolphin-human connection, what we have in common, And it really starts in the womb all the way to telecommunication,
mm-hmm.
because dolphins and whales have been doing that form of communication, sending wireless messages over vast distances for 30 to 40 million years. So we've created a phone and a computer to talk digitally, to do the same, essentially the same type of communication on land that they're doing in the ocean. But we also communicate holographically, and the same, so they talk digitally primarily.
Right.
Right. Right. We do too. But most people think that we're just all brain, but we're not all brain. Mm-hmm. Our brain does the analog part. And our heart, we actually have a thinking heart system, and that does the digital part of us.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at any drawings like that Leonardo da Vinci did of the human body, he shows the center of our body, and that's really where one invisible energy comes from us. It's our, and I'll make a reference back to the womb. It's a lot easier to show in diagrams and pictures because mm-hmm. the picture talking is the first language we learn, but it's through sound that we feel.
Mm-hmm.
So that first language that we're learning in the womb as a child growing in our mother's womb, we're learning the language of sound that we're feeling,
yeah.
right? The heartbeat, sounds outside. That's why it's so important of the environment that pregnant women are in,
right?
From everything from music to if she's in stressful situations, because all of that, the baby growing is, that's basically they're learning the environment that they're going to be born into.
Uh-huh.
And then yeah. actually when a child is born in water, from the water womb into water, we naturally know how to hold our breath underwater mm-hmm. as a child.
Mm-hmm.
Like they... There was scientists, I started to study water birthing in the 80s. So I have articles from Michael Ordon to Dr. Igor Tchaikovsky. And they did studies with babies that were born in the water. They became almost like super children because their right brain and left brain were allowed to align, besides not having the shock of going from water to land with the gravity.
Right.
They were allowed to assimilate in almost like a seamless birthing process,
yeah.
which they aligned the baby back to the mother's heartbeat before they cut the umbilical cord. This is like an ideal way of the water birth.
Mm-hmm.
Plus, there was no trauma happening from the water to the water.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So supposedly a lot of our thinking that we're disconnected to life happens through the birthing process. So our connectivity, the benefit that I just had, I wanted to do lectures and talks, but the format of the environment really didn't allow it to have a microphone and
sure.
because it was a lounge room. But I was going to show a fishbowl,
mm-hmm.
basically an empty fishbowl, and ask everyone in the audience, does that look empty or full to you? And let people respond,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
So most people are walking around almost in a sleepless slumber, forgetting that we have all these great connections of why we matter, why our life is essential to our planet's existence, and down to our breath.
Okay,
so in that bowl, it's actually, some people would say it's empty. Some people would say, well, it could be full of like the air that we're breathing. Right? Well, our breath, every day, if you talk to an astrophysicist, like Tom Chi, he does a TED Talk about this.
Mm-hmm.
He was the co-founder of the Google X. He talks about our 7% of our breath. Our breath comes from, we get our breath being on a water planet. So most of our breaths that we're breathing every day come from courtesy of the ocean.
Mm-hmm.
So whether or not we're living on land in the middle of a city, we still have the ocean wave in every breath we take. Our blood moves in the same pattern as an ocean wave. Our breath moves in the same pattern of an ocean wave. That's not coincidence. That's actually divine right. design in us.
Couple things real quick.
Yes.
I was not aware until a very short time ago that the ocean actually produced oxygen. I did not know. I thought it only came from the plants and the trees, and that we didn't want to cut everything down because basically we were cutting off our oxygen supply. By the same token, when I found out about the ocean also providing oxygen, we're doing the same thing because we're polluting it and so forth.
Actually, the tiniest plant lives in the ocean, the phytoplankton, and that's where we get primarily the majority of our oxygen that we're breathing.
So it's still from a plant.
Still from a plant.
But it's out in the ocean.
But living in the ocean.
Yeah,
so that's why it's so, I mean, there's a new video about why whales help our ecosystem.
Yeah.
Because the way that they go to the bathroom and they bring nutrients from the bottom of the ocean and they bring it up to the surface, that's a part of basically oxygenating the surface of the ocean.
Right.
So plants grow better because they grow faster and better without pollution, right? And without the chemicals and close to the sunlight.
Another thing you mentioned in terms of our initial levels of communication, and you were referring to the holographic aspects, and we communicate through images. The first thing I thought of as far as the first humans on the planet were the cave drawings, which is how they would maybe even communicate. Maybe that wasn't something, it wasn't art. It was, they were trying to communicate with one another to tell the other person, yeah, this is what we're going to go out and we're going to hunt, or, you know, those kind, or this is what I saw out there, and they would draw it on the wall. That kind of thing.
I think so. Because I think we were talking the other day about your communication with your dogs and cats.
Yeah.
Right? What animals, all animals are in the present moment. So when you have a picture in your thought of what you're going to do, they know in advance because they're receiving the picture. So we picture talk first. And most people, because they don't see it, it's the invisible realm.
Right.
But we're already dealing with four other energy fields that are invisible: gravity, electromagnetic, and two types of nuclear. So on our daily level, why we get tired is because our brain is always having to kind of balance out the gravity part of our life.
Mm-hmm.
Also, we're sensing our world. So every time we sense our world, that comes from the center of our body.
Mm-hmm.
That's the thinking part of our heart center. We communicate back and forth from our heart center up to our brain in a form of communication that goes over our 40,000 neurons a day.
Mm-hmm.
So if you look up cardioenergetic scientists that are doing heart transplants, they will tell you they've measured our heart's electromagnetic field versus our brain's electromagnetic field. Our heart's center, the center where we're sensing our world, you know, instinct, how we feel, all that stuff, it's 5,000 times stronger than our brain.
Wow.
Yeah, our brain is actually the analog system. It's organizing everything.
Yeah.
So the data that we bring in, the communication that we're doing, when we go into a room, we sense it. And then those feelings go up to our brain and they tell us how we're feeling. So it's like we feel safe, we feel good, that person makes us feel awkward. You know, it's what you do when you step in an arena with a wild horse or a horse to do like horse whispering.
Right.
They're sensing you. You have to get in tune and in sync with them. Our eyes are one way that you, if you change your eye movement to where a different part of the horse's body, he feels that and will move according to how you move your eyes. So we're always communicating with one another, not only with the animal kingdom, with each other that way. And that's when that's the holographic communication, that it's not a seen way of communication, but it's the first language that we learn. And then most people, they're just not practicing it conscious.
Yeah.
So the difference with what would you like to ask?
Well, I was gonna touch also upon the birthing process that you've described of women who have natural childbirth in water. And if I'm not mistaken, I think there is a technique now that has been developed over, I don't know, maybe the last 10 or 20 years, where adults can actually re-experience and be submerged, and I don't think it's water, it's some other fluid, that they're actually able to breathe. They're conscious, they're awake, they're not drowning. Mm-hmm. They're actually, and it is a little scary, I'm sure, at first, because it's like, it's not natural for us to inhale liquids through our, into our air passages. But in this case, they're able to do that. And then the liquids go in, but there's no harm done. And they're conscious, they're aware, they're able to move about, this kind of thing. This is like being back in the womb. Because originally, we had fluid flowing in and out of us.
And we lose that connection when we learn how to walk on land. So somehow that gets severed. But people who do free diving, they start actually almost practicing that ancient connection, that aquatic connection that we have. So they kind of reactivate almost like a muscle that we have.
They get practiced in it. Okay.
Because there's one piece that I talk about that's land, sea, and we. We're all in this together. So the things that we do on land affect the sea, vice versa, that comes back to us.
Yes.
So we're never not. So back to that fishbowl thing about our breath.
Right.
So with the astrophysics, 7% of our oxygen every day we breathe out. And every day we take in 7% that's new. In 3 or 4 days, or I think really about 4 or 5 days, that 7% that we breathed out today, 4 or 5 days later, that oxygen, our breath, is on the other side of the earth, creating life for a plant, a tree, an animal is breathing that in. So when we think we're not connected, how come we're essentially built to be connected?
Right.
Because we're sharing our breath with every living thing that's breathing.
And I'll add one more thing to that. This was a scientific, I guess, study or project that they were working on. They were actually able to, you know what carbon dating is. You know that process. Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, they did something similar with the molecules of the oxygen that we breathe. And they were able to begin that process of, and it wasn't carbon dating, but for lack of a better term, they were actually able to carbon date some of these molecules. And some of them were hours, days, months, weeks, years, decades, centuries, millennia old. And so they basically, again, this was all in the process of tying our connectedness together. They said that the molecules that you breathe in today may have been the same molecules of oxygen that the great masters over the centuries breathed in and then out again.
That's why we get those deja vus.
Yeah.
Right? Because I say the ocean is alive.
Right.
And then the ocean's in every breath we're taking.
Right.
But it's also in our DNA. So we're actually sharing our DNA. When people talk about the collective consciousness, I once had, while I was working on that dolphin talk, I had never talked to a dragonfly before. I've talked to other animals. I'm in the pool, just, looking up at the sky, relaxing, taking a break from doing some editing and writing of my book. I go back in. Well, I'm in the pool. There was one section that I knew I needed to change that I had talked about later, but I knew it was not written properly the way that it needed to be, about the ocean being in every breath that we take. All of a sudden, I have this dragonfly hovering over me saying, all of a sudden, I get this thought that I'm not thinking about in my head saying, you need to change that part in your book to this. And my response back to the dragonfly was, how did you know what's in my book when it hasn't been published yet? Such a dork I am, right? It's like, so my response, and you know what the dragonfly said? It's already in the collective consciousness.
Yeah.
So I didn't understand scientifically what that dragonfly said until a few years later. Like in the last 3 years, I've been trying to gather the scientific evidence to support holographic communication. Because most people, if you tell them I've had conversations with animals, they normally give me like the crazy look. Until their animals is about to die and then they want me to come over and talk to them. Right?
Yeah.
And then the animal's telling me stuff that I would never know to tell their parents.
Yeah.
Right? Or there's certain circumstances. And I don't always have that channel open because to me it's like a gift and I never take it for granted. that dragonfly, it was a female, right? Mm-hmm. She told me, she like, you know, that's, mm-hmm. I wouldn't know that. She flew off. I was still in the pool.
Yeah.
And I was still kind of pondering, you know.
What you just experienced. Yeah, like
how she knew. And then I just had talked with the dragonfly. Then she flew back over and she told me something that I wasn't even close to even thinking about. She says, what you call Alzheimer's is when someone starts living in the present moment. What you guys call dementia is when someone starts accessing different dimensions. And why would she be telling me that? I mean, the interesting thing is I have a 100-year-old grandmother,
mm-hmm.
right? I call her Grandmu, and her name is Grandmu Beach, like the ocean.
Right.
When I'm with her, it takes her, like I just went to visit her when it was her 100th birthday. She looked at me. And she knew that she knew me from somewhere,
right?
It took about 10 minutes, and all of a sudden, it just clicked in. And she's present moment to moment. But she also started to get all of her ancient memories back. And she was making, like, the person that's her caregiver, that's with her 4 days a week, 5 hours a day. When I was saying goodbye to her on the first day, I saw her 2 days in a row. On the first day, she's like, aren't you taking me back home? And I said, no, you're a caregiver. Who's she? Right? So it's like my voice, how we remember each other is voice, but she's really present moment.
Right.
And then she's accessing dimensions because she has this beautiful childlike like quality about her that so much that when a child is aware of their environment, it's dimensionally.
Yeah.
That's why they're so sensitive.
It sounds to me like the description that you gave, for example, of our dogs.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. If they were human, exhibiting exactly the same behaviors, if you will, of being in the moment,
mm-hmm.
we would probably say they have Alzheimer's, right? Because of the description you just gave mm-hmm. from the dragonfly, who said that Alzheimer's is they're living in now. What do they need the information from the past or the future? And that's another thing about your book. Your book's already been written. It's just that we are both thinking on a linear timeline
instead of a
human construct.
Yes.
Instead of exactly right.
Well, I mean, part of the thing is we get tired when we're on land. And the difference when you look at a dolphin and whale brain, they use 40% more of their brain capacity than humans because of the buoyancy level. So as we get older, as the years go by, we lose our buoyancy. So the water element, when we're actually born, I'm sometimes dyslexic, so I switch numbers around.
Mm-hmm.
So it's actually a 71% to 29% water to body mass. We match our planet exactly when we're a baby.
Okay.
For communication levels. It's not like, that's why when Einstein was working on the divinity in nature right before he passed,
mm-hmm.
it was about those divine mathematical formulas of the reason why we match nature, the reason why we match each other, the reason why that gives us channels to communicate. It gives us channels to be have compassion
mm-hmm.
and sensitivity towards one another for a reason, because we're meant to be working together.
Yeah.
We're not meant to be opposed, like thinking of all the things we don't have in common.
Right.
We should be thinking about how can we lend mm-hmm. a hand because we are better together.
Yes, yes.
Right.
Now, were the numbers wrong when I was a kid in science class when they said that the human body is made up of 97% water? Was that a little higher than it should be? Or is it in the 90s? Or is it at that 70%, as you say, compared
to the
Earth? Yeah, the
71-29% water to body mass. But this is the cool thing.
Okay.
If you look at the chemistry of us, we're actually, the chemistry is different than the biology. The
right.
chemistry of us, we're actually 60% oxygen. And what happens when oxygen meets water? Like, say you want to go into the ocean or a shower or the lake.
Mm-hmm.
What happens when our 60% body of oxygen goes and meets water? What happens when those molecules happen in science? Oxygen dissolves into water. So we actually dissolve. That's why it feels so good when we go into the shower,
okay.
when we go into the ocean, when we go into a lake,
mm-hmm.
when we feel out of sorts,
yeah.
if we're having a rough day, give yourself a break, go into the bathroom,
yeah.
stick your hands, stick your feet, whatever you can do, and some water.
Right.
And it has kind of your dissolving back into the water, so you can dispel some of the stuff that you're like having trouble with. Because it's not like like you saw me the other night. I get frustrated, right? I get overwhelmed.
Yeah.
Sometimes I feel like I've worked with a lot of challenged children and adults with animals.
Mm-hmm.
Horse program.
Sure.
I see their sensitivity and the way they filter in that holographic communication.
Right.
They don't have very many filters that so-called non-autistic people or other people who don't have challenges. And when we get overwhelmed,
mm-hmm.
right, like I feel more autistic in the way that I take in information, because sometimes I can be overwhelmed. If the music is off and then people are loud and then there's a jackhammer going, you know, 24/7 in the day, I feel agitated.
Yeah.
Right? So I need to go out in nature, go in some water, do something to change my wave patterns in mm-hmm. my body mm-hmm. because I'm feeling out of sorts.
Right.
Right? And then we all have that. We're all digesting this holographic communication, and sometimes we don't know why we're feeling not in tune.
Right.
Right? And so that's why I offer the reconnecting back with water.
Right. I know the people who finish their workday, for example, they'll go home and this is the way they'll describe it, by jumping in the shower. They say, oh, I'm rinsing off the day.
Mm-hmm.
It was really hectic, or it was this, or it was that, or it was the other, and I'm just going to rinse off the day. And actually what they're doing is they're reconnecting.
And reviving their molecules and their DNA, because where do we hold our memories? This is the cool thing. You know, like I think the first thing when we talk about communication outside of the language that we're doing right now, right? It's mm-hmm. a wave pattern.
Right.
Sound is the basis of all shape and form.
Right.
Right. So it's actually what makes up our universe.
Mm-hmm.
So this is one way of communicating. But most of the time, we communicate first off with that our sixth sense. We're always communicating, and everything is how we feel. Because when you take the word emotion,
mm-hmm.
it's emotion, energy, mm-hmm. frequencies, and motion.
Right.
So basically, how we're feeling, that goes out as ripples. So when people think our words don't matter, they do matter.
Oh,
and
God,
ancient cultures never had negatives. You communicate with an animal, they don't communicate in negatives. They communicate in our first language, and our first language is present moment positives.
Yeah.
You say, don't jump on the couch,
mm-hmm.
they get jump on the couch.
That's what they get.
Yeah, because they're getting the visual of what you're not. Modern day humans are the only ones that talk in what we don't want, not the positive.
What we do want.
Yeah, so in the ancient languages, you have to kind of, that's why it's so fascinating, holographic communication and communication with animals, because it touches every part of our modern day life. Someone that's doing internet telecommunication, I could talk to them how dolphin language actually affects their world, right? Really beautiful.
Now, if you're not near the ocean, you're in the middle of a country, whether it be the United States or Saudi Arabia or the middle of the gulag in Russia or something of this nature, some would say, well, but I am not anywhere near a dolphin. How can I communicate with the dolphins? I want to talk about that when we come back.
Okay.
But I want to talk more also about your background. You are a marine biologist, is that correct?
I study marine biology.
You study marine biology.
Yeah, so.
Okay. And we'll talk a little bit more about your background as well as we continue, all right? We'll do that as
Sounds
we return with Dolphin Girl.
Dolphin Girl or Dove Jones? Yeah,
Dove
both.
Jones. Either way, we're going to come back here on Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan, and we ask you to stay right where you are. We'll be right back.
One of the most exciting scientific findings of the past half century has been the discovery of widespread trophic cascades. A trophic cascade is an ecological process which starts at the top of the food chain and tumbles all the way down to the bottom. We all know that whales eat fish and krill. And some people, certain politicians in Japan, for instance, have argued that killing whales is good for human beings, as it boosts the food available for us to eat. And so you would think. But as the great whales declined, so did the numbers of fish and krill. It seems counterintuitive. Surely their numbers would rise as their major predators disappeared. But it now turns out that whales not only eat these animals, they also keep them alive. In fact, they help to sustain the entire living system of the ocean. Whales feed at depth in waters that are often pitch dark, and then they return to the surface, to the photic zone, where there's enough light for photosynthesis to happen. There they release what biologists call fecal plumes, vast outpourings of poo, poonamis. These plumes are rich in iron and nitrogen, nutrients which are often very scarce in the surface waters. And these nutrients fertilize the plant plankton that lives in the only place where plants can survive, the photic zone. Fertilizing the surface waters isn't the only thing the whales do. By plunging up and down through the water column, they also keep kicking the plankton back up into the photic zone, giving it more time to reproduce before it sinks into the abyss. Even today, though whale populations have been greatly reduced, the vertical mixing of water caused by movements of animals up and down through the column of the oceans is astonishingly roughly the same as the amount of mixing caused by all the world's wind and waves and tides. More plant plankton means more animal plankton on which the larger creatures then feed. In other words, more whales means more fish and krill. But the story doesn't end here, because plant plankton not only feeds the animals of the sea, it also absorbs carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. When eventually it sinks to the ocean floor, it takes this carbon out of circulation, down to a place where it remains for thousands of years. The more whales there are, the more plankton there is. The more plankton there is, the more carbon is drawn out of the air. When whales were at their historical populations, before great numbers of them were killed, it seems that they might have been responsible for removing tens of millions of tons of carbon from the atmosphere every year. Whales change the climate. The return of the great whales, if they're allowed to recover, could be seen as a benign form of geoengineering. It could undo some of the damage we've done, both to the living systems of the sea and to the atmosphere.
Welcome back to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan here on this program as we come your way every Sunday at 7 a.m. and 7 p.m., Monday mornings at 1 a.m., archiving at richarddugan.com, the radio show's page, and we will also link to our guest, Dove Jones, here on the program. I have to be very careful and make sure that I say Dove Jones, because my best friend from grade school, high school, and college, and even to this day, name is Doug Jones.
I've been called Doug lots of times. But, you know, my last name was my middle name. Mm-hmm. I actually have an Italian last name. But when I was changing it, there was just some family issues, and I really wanted kind of my own art and creative name.
And your own identity.
My own identity.
Yeah.
And in retrospect, I think, why didn't I change it to my grandma's last name, which, or my mother's maiden name, which is Beach, like mm-hmm. the ocean beach.
Dove Beach. Right?
And this is the cool thing about ancestry and names. How before we were talking about how powerful a word is.
Mm-hmm.
And just to finish that thought, ancient cultures like the Aborigines and Native Americans and any like non-modern society way mm-hmm. of living, the first thing that when they went in to kind of so-called civilize a culture and oftentimes control them, they wanted to take away their language. Well, an ancient language sounds different than a modern-day language because ancient languages, you talk to an Aboriginal elder, which I've had the pleasure of interacting with, they don't have negatives. In fact, if you talk to a Hawaiian kahuna, they basically said if they had a feeling that was a negative, mm-hmm. they made a sound instead of a word because they oh. know how powerful that one word goes out.
Interesting.
The neat thing about dolphins and whales and mm-hmm. one word and one sound that they make in the ocean, you know what pattern it is? Okay, so the pattern is the same thing that a Buddhist monk and a dolphin have in common. What do you think?
Are you talking about the throat singing?
The guttural? No, kind of close.
Okay.
But it's actually they're making mandalas. They're making regenerative patterns with their sound in the water, but they do it with one word. So I'm working with an acoustic scientist. Those images will be in the second book, The I Am Dolphin, mm-hmm. to show proof of the value of dolphins and whales and just how powerful one word can be. So our words, it's like saying in our language, words can be flowers or they can be daggers. We can mm-hmm. use words. They have a wave pattern that when they go out, they either cause kindness and love and happiness or they cause hurt.
Yeah,
that's how powerful words are. And I think when you see these images, they look like intricate flowers or mandalas. And the Buddhist monks, they make those mandalas as symbols of peace. So there's a reason why people get excited about dolphins. They have been a symbol of friendship and love and peace. And
I have to wonder, though, how important is it for us humans to be swimming around with them? I really question that sometimes, not just about dolphins, but about us trying to interact on a much closer level to the various wild animals. It seems to me like we're encroaching enough on their territory, on their habitat, that, you know what, I don't think they really want us there. And I'm curious as to what you've experienced, what you've heard, what you've picked up, as to how they feel, how the dolphins in particular feel about us going out into the oceans, trying to find them so that we can get close to them and pet them and...
Well, we're not legally supposed to be touching them.
Okay, but so put the legal aside. I'm talking about that
interaction. My take is, and what I talk about in my first book, with any communication with any animal, you ask for permission.
Mm-hmm.
You don't enter someone's house without ringing the doorbell
or knocking. Usually.
Right? I mean,
right,
no.
Exactly.
You normally ask for permission to enter into their world. The same with... You know, sharks, I've been in the water when a huge gray shark swam up to me not knowing that the shark was right next to me. I'm upside down, listening to the whales sing. It was my birthday. I had swam out. The dolphins were around. You know, people say, oh, there's never sharks when there's dolphin. Not true. I'm swimming back to shore. And I think, I love the whale sound so much, I'm going to listen to them again. So I do headstands because... When you have your head closer to the sand, the sound wave patterns are stronger.
Mm-hmm.
I'm down there. All of a sudden, I feel someone next to me, like within 5 to 10 feet. It was probably about 10 feet away
mm-hmm.
to the left. So I come up straight, and I'm under the water, right, holding my breath. I look to my left. There is a big shark looking at me.
Right.
And normally, sharks need to be moving to have the air go through their gills.
Right. Right. That's what I've heard, yes.
And so I said to the shark, because we're all talking telepathic, And it's not this woo-hoo word and concept. All of us every day are talking telepathic back and forth to one another. We have thoughts, we have wishes, we send them out all the time to one another. So it's a form of, yes, it's telepathy. My hello was basically sent from my mind to my heart, like my intention, mm-hmm. to the shark. So I said, hello, shark. It was just my initial response because I was, one, surprised that he was so close, right, looking at me. And the minute I said hello, acknowledged the presence of the shark, then it turned off and swam away.
Wow.
So I think that part of going out into the wild habitats, you have to be aware that you're entering into their world. When I go up, I mean, I've had to swim myself in front of tourists who mm-hmm. have been trying to grab and hang on to gentle sea turtles, right? Number one, they're endangered.
Yeah.
It's like a $5,000 fine. You don't hang on to them and think it's cool just to do a selfie.
Yeah.
So I think there's an extreme part about wanting to be, everyone wants to be close to wild animals. Why? Why is that? It's because they are holding secrets that to our lives that we haven't figured out. And those secrets are, we're connected. We're communicating. And if, to me, when I have questions about life, I go to nature.
Yeah.
I go to animals and they will, you know, give me something that I hadn't thought out. I make 3 points in my book about how I know I'm communicating with an animal and it's not my imaginings.
Right.
Number one, it's normally original thought,
mm-hmm.
like the one about Alzheimer's and dementia.
Right.
Right. Original thought. The second one is it's not something I'm thinking about prior to that moment. And number third, which is most important, it's normally smarter than me. So like I'm actually, you know, learning. There's even, I mean, in lots of faith-based practices, even to the Old Testament in the Bible, it actually says, ask the animals and they will teach you. Mm. Speak to the birds and they will tell you. Ask the earth and it will teach you and show you. Speak to the fish. Like it's basically saying in that one scripture in the Old Testament that we all share one breath.
Yeah.
I don't know what idea that humans thought that we should be domineering over everything in existence. We're supposed to be companion. And in fact, I think when we feel peaceful, it's when we're actually working in sync with everyone else.
Yeah. We're supposed to be caretakers.
Yeah, caretakers.
I think that the word that a lot of people like to use from the Bible when it comes to our quote-unquote dominance over the plants and animals of the planet is we are to, I can't, now the word just.
Custodians?
No, not even custodians. It's more controlling and more restrictive than that. Usurp almost is the way that they use the word. And again, it escapes me. But I understand what you're talking about, and I tend to agree. I also use nature as the greatest teacher because it doesn't matter what subject you bring up, okay? You could bring up religion. I prefer philosophy.
Mm-hmm.
You could bring up economics, okay? For example, what species other than man stores up food for more than one season?
Squirrels.
No, squirrels don't store up for more than one season.
What do you mean one season?
One season. They're going to store up in spring and and summer and into the fall for the winter. And then they'll start all over again in the spring, starting to gather and store up for the coming winter. They don't store up for 5 years or 10 years.
They store up for a season.
A season.
Yeah, so.
But what do? We store up, what are they? Twinkies will not go bad on the shelf. 100 years from now, those Twinkies that were made today, they will be just as good as they were today. 100 years from now.
That's scary.
We hoard, for one. We store, and that's really what it is. So if we would learn from nature, we could devise a more sustainable economic system. There is no other species on the planet that does what we do, that to our own detriment. I don't know of any other species that acts in such a way as it's going to ensure its own self-destruction.
Well, that's like a fear base.
Exactly.
So when I talk about a dolphin mentality, mm-hmm. it's really because you can only be in one mode of being, thinking, and yeah. it's either faith-based or fear-based. Mm-hmm. So when we're in faith, we trust, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
We also reach out and interact with people in a different, you know, mode. So it's...
And can I shift gears just a little bit here? Yeah. I wanted to ask you a little bit about that, you know, faith versus fear. Because what it spurred in my mind, in your communications, has there ever been any dialogue in regards to intuition? And you talk about trust. And if they're living in the moment, there is no need per se for intuition. They just are doing what they're doing right here and now. They're not thinking ahead, you know, 2 miles down the ocean coast. Okay, they're right there right now.
Well, this is an interesting thing. Let's see, it's in 1987, so 30 years ago,
mm-hmm.
a wild dolphin in Australia told me, we don't have anger or fear in our vocabulary, and we only know those frequencies from humans.
Oh.
So imagine hearing that from a wild dolphin. Why? There was one place that I lived in Australia every day, or you know, at least 4 or 5 times a week, I would go across the street through the sand dunes.
Mm-hmm.
The minute I set down my towel to go into the water for mm-hmm. a swim, this little pod of dolphins would meet me directly in front of wherever I was. And it didn't matter what time it was. They knew that I was going to be there. The minute I turned around, they were there waiting for me. So swimming parallel with me, the baby would come in closest to me. So for whatever reason, this family allowed the baby to kind of be close to me. Mm-hmm. And they protected me from the open ocean, swimming parallel.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it was quite wild.
Okay. So you've had the experience of obviously swimming with the dolphins, swimming near them at the very least. Okay.
Yeah, and having them tell me things when I've asked them, like, what would you like us to do?
Okay.
I mean, this is like in the... And one threw out a piece of plastic. This is in the 80s,
yeah.
right? Throwing a piece of plastic that I didn't see in the ocean. Like, bloody pick out the trash
yeah.
from the sea.
Yeah.
You know, don't throw your trash in the ocean.
Yeah.
So, you know, that form of community, like you asked me earlier about everyone wanting to be close to wild animals.
Right.
There is for me, I asked for permission. And then I always give them an opportunity to swim towards me. So I'm not racing after them.
Right.
Right? I go out there and say, I make a request. Would you like to play?
Mm-hmm.
Right? So would you like to swim with me? I would really like to swim with you. Or if I'm having, normally I used to go down to the ocean if I was having a bad, you know, moment and talk mm-hmm. to them. Like I really need a friend.
Yeah.
They were there, my family. They were more my family, what I needed from my family than... Sometimes my own family members were.
Right.
Just kind of that love and understanding and acceptance.
Mm-hmm.
Like one time before I came back to Santa Barbara, I was like, am I just crazy? Why should I be working on this to try to save the New Zealand Mauis?
Yeah.
You know, I was using every ounce of, you know, money I had to stay in Australia to keep on campaigning
mm-hmm.
to save the world's smallest and rarest dolphin. And I said, am I just crazy? Why should I? So I'm talking out to the ocean, right? All of a sudden, a dolphin from nowhere does a beeline straight into where I'm standing, like basically knee deep in the waves. I mean, it was just like, okay, I got the message. So I'm always surprised when something like that yeah. happens. Because
okay. But you've had the opportunity to do that, okay?
Yes.
To be close to them in that respect and obviously communicate with them. But as I brought up at the end of the last segment, what if we're not in proximity physically to the ocean? And this is one of the reasons why I moved, not specifically to Santa Barbara, but to the ocean. I had this urgent need, and it took me years to do it, to move to the ocean shore, to the shore where the ocean was.
Mm.
I don't know why, other than it may be very well what you described in the first segment about our connectedness, especially when it comes to water and obviously the whole aspect of oxygen and breath and on and on and on. But what about someone who's listening on the internet to the stream and lives in the middle, in the breadbasket of America, or in the middle of Africa between two shores, hundreds if not thousands of miles away? We're not talking about communicating with the dolphins specifically. We're talking about a form of communication that the dolphins use.
I'm talking holographic communication is happening all over our planet.
Okay.
Right? So if you're not close to the ocean, you can experience holographic communication in a few forms. That's the beautiful thing that I'll be talking about in my second book, and that's why I've been planning to go on this environmental tour, to mm-hmm. be able to share that with people in the middle of Africa, mm-hmm. not near any ocean.
Right.
Guess what they have drawings of? Their interaction with dolphins and the Dogon tribe. It's part of the legend of the golden dolphin. And the very opening of our segment, you played John Denver.
Yes.
Well, John Denver, this is a really cool story, is part of that legend of the golden dolphin. And unbeknownst to me, when I was quite young on my dolphin quest, because I told my parents when I was, you know, not even in, I had just gotten out of elementary school and I was in junior high, telling them that I was going to do interspecies communication with dolphins. It's because I had an epiphany from that one song of a humpback whale going into me, and I felt like I was known, that whale knew me intimately, like no other human had known me, mm-hmm. like really knew my essence, knew my heart, knew my soul, and loved me for who I was. I got that all in one song. And it's because those sound wave patterns, right, what I describe and which I'll show in my new book, are regenerative. They are like sending someone a really rich flower. Well, wave patterns, when 30 years ago, when that wild dolphin told me we don't have any anger, I'll get back to John Denver in mm-hmm. a second. When we don't have any anger or fear in our vocabulary, right? When we operate out of anger and fear, we make wave patterns that they don't touch our DNA matrix because they're running on different channels.
Okay.
So if you talk with a genetic specialist, what wave patterns are they using to cure cancer? 528. 528 is a wave pattern of love. It's been measured as a frequency of love. What do all botanicals in nature resonate? What frequency do they?
528.
So that's why when we're feeling frazzled, mm-hmm. if we're not near, you know, a dolphin or the ocean, there is a plant, there is a tree, there is a dog, there is a cat. And there's also beautiful things that humans have created. We've created the arts. That creates holographic communication. Mm-hmm. Music. When I lived in Nashville and was doing my storytelling years of learning how to communicate with humans.
Right.
Because I was so used to animal talking, and I thought everyone could talk with animals.
I like that.
I was so shy. I was, growing up, I was overweight. How I got into communicating with nature and animals is because I came from a very abusive household that was unpredictable, like volatile. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't always like that. But then I was mixed up, like, what is love? What are my belief system?
Yeah.
So I started talking to nature, right? And feeling closer to animals. And I started seeing animals in people. Like I'd say, oh, that person is like a hawk. Oh, that person is like a, you know, leopard. And years later, when I did Indian sweats mm-hmm. with Native Americans, I'd come out or even in there and I went around to each person and I said, this is your totem. I could hear the sound that came from them during that sweat. Of whatever animal. And it was typically one of their favorite animals.
Wow.
Like someone was like a baby harp seal. I mean, it was just this. So I've had my way of healing. I believe that why I want to share this knowledge with people is because the power of animal and dolphin communication will enhance, but also heal parts of our lives. Because yeah. we all have something in our life that we'd like some healing mm-hmm. about, right? And I think for me, that's what when I had that recognition from that whale song, I knew that was my, I had no other question. I started reading all I could on pioneering research with dolphin communication, because at that time, only Roger Payne had done those recordings, which helped to protect whales in the water, because we were still killing them. They still weren't protected in the marine mammal protection. Yeah. That happened in the 80s. So
tell me about your connection with John Denver, because there was something he said. They online there was a memorial video they put together, and a quote from him basically was that one of the things that we need to get back to is nature, you know, that we want to be wild and free.
Mm-hmm.
It was the phrase that he used. And when I first heard it the very first time, I'm thinking, are you kidding me? We got too much wildness and freedom in this country as it is. People are going nuts, tearing the place apart, which is not what he meant. He was talking about being wild and free as the animals are wild and free.
The essence of who an animal is. People want to study dolphins, but they put them in captivity.
Yeah.
Right? You actually strip away everything that's the essence of a dolphin. The essence of a dolphin is the we mentality.
Yeah.
Family, community, you know, togetherness. So with John Denver, why I was on my dolphin quest, I ended up going to the Windstar symposiums two summers in a row. Mm. And I actually helped. So John Denver created Windstar, right? So it was this beautiful piece of property out in Old Snowmass in Colorado. And it was, there was gardens there, designs from, he was friends with Buckminster Fuller and Bucky's family. And so there's geodesic domes and gardens. So I ended up, through a number of different choices that I made, going out there. And then I was in charge of the Russian exchange program. So everyone came to the Windstar to speak about what we could do for the environment. So there was all these key people from all over the world, like Margaret Thatcher came one year. And so I was in charge of them. And the shape of the property of Windstar is in the shape of a whale, like a sperm whale.
Oh, wow.
So back to the legend of the golden dolphin. When I had first gone over to, so why I was at Windstar, I ended up meeting John Denver's partner, which is Tommy Grum, that used to teach Aikido to all these corporations and companies and, you know, like seminars. And basically, he gave me this connection of the legend of the golden dolphin that was in Australia. So it was this one man who had done studies about all the different connections from the Dogon tribe in Africa to back to the Greeks to everything. And John was a part of that. And in fact, that one Australian was trying to contact John about the legend of the golden dolphin. So I ended up getting a job offer. I went to Australia before, when I was pretty much a very young, you know, I say a child because I was so innocent. I didn't have a computer. The computers weren't, you know, in there in like the mid-80s. It was before Crocodile Dundee had come out. I thought from, I was at the time living in Hawaii, so I went to Windstar, came back to Hawaii, and then when I flew with the job offer, because I got certified in neuro-linguistic programming, which I decided that I wasn't going to practice as a profession, but it was my way of actually meeting the whole Windstar thing and making that dolphin connection. So I, back then, I was very naive and I was very trusting, and I went from moment to moment trusting that my quest of interspecies communication would take me to the next moment, to the next moment. I mean, so I went there with that job. That job ended up basically falling through within a week through complications. I was supposed to be teaching a child with learning disabilities, and there was some struggle over the parents who were getting a divorce. And then I walked the streets of city life, like Sydney, with $50 in my hand, never living in a city life before, and, you know, walked into one time a bar because I became friends with these Asian people. I walk in, there was In Excess sitting there, Michael Hutchinson.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so I was like walking into these, I was like a Forrest Gump, kind of meandering into things just because. So I, what ended up happening, I didn't have a very nice kind of first month or two, but then all of a sudden I looked for a job in the paper, and in the paper was this assistant manager at a float to relaxation center place on like the Tiburon part of Sausalito part of Sydney.
Mm-hmm.
So I took the ferry over, and basically while I was waiting for my job interview, I opened up the magazine, and there was the Legend of the Golden Dolphin contact, the same person that John Denver's right-hand person had told me about in this magazine. I got hired on the spot, and those float tanks were designed by the pioneer researcher, Dr. John Lilly, that wanted to know how dolphins thought. He wanted to be able to communicate them, so he created the relaxation flotation tank, the Samadhi tank.
Oh, wow.
So I ended up managing in that center and another center for a whole year in Australia.
Tell us about the Golden Dolphin story.
The Legend of the Golden Dolphin. It's really about our connectivity to dolphins. So without the science part, the part that I would like to bring in to our connectivity with dolphins, it's about the ancient links that we have starting, you know, almost in our DNA. Because like you said, with the molecules and how they can test to see what time period those molecules are from,
mm-hmm.
all of those are being stored in the ocean, right? So if we're sharing the ocean breath and every, you know, an ocean wave and every breath that we take, when you say we're in the middle of a city, how are we connected? Well, we're breathing an ocean wave, right? Because we wouldn't have breath, we wouldn't have life. The difference from humans to dolphins and whales, and I'm pretty sure there's a few other animals that are conscious breathers, but right now, humanity in the whole are unconscious breathers, meaning that we go to sleep at night, we don't think about that we have to be conscious of every breath we take.
Mm-hmm.
A dolphin and a whale thinks every breath is a choice for them. That's what happened with Rick O'Berry with the flipper dolphin. The last flipper dolphin, all five of those flipper dolphins from that TV show that he trained and worked with were all female because males can't be trainable in captivity.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So Kathy basically took her last breath and held it and sunk to the bottom. So she chose that she didn't want to be in captivity anymore and died virtually in Rick's arms. And that's what's switched Rick from being a dolphin trainer into the last almost 40 years of fighting for their wild and free, the essence of how they should be, because they swim 50 miles a day mm-hmm. in the open ocean. They have beautiful family dynamics.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just...
By the way, you mentioned in the first segment about sharks.
Mm-hmm.
I saw a piece not too long ago about how this gentleman... He has been doing some research and study of sharks and says that the greatest harm that has ever been done to sharks started with the movie Jaws, and that he swims with the sharks. He shows them respect. He is not fearful of them. He acknowledges where he is. He acknowledges where they are and who they are, what they are, and does not interfere with them, and yet they will swim around him in a very gentle way. I was watching this video, this segment on a magazine program on television, where he took another gentleman down there with him, along with the camera crew, and there were sharks everywhere. Okay,
mm-hmm.
And certainly to attract them, they threw the chum out into the water to bring them in, but once they were there, they didn't make any aggressive moves towards the sharks and vice versa. It was the most gentle experience I had ever seen with humans and sharks.
Hmm.
And there they were. And they would even come close enough to him, even rubbing up against him.
Yeah, they like, especially their nose.
Yeah.
I have some friends who are really big Sea Shepherd supporters in Australia. And one in particular... She's known as Shark Girl,
mm-hmm.
and she has some great experience underwater footage. Her dad, when she was quite young, went out with her. And there's a way that kind of relaxes the shark.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's kind of a rubbing on the nose. And just, you know, I've had that, you know, the interaction with a shark. And also a great white. It was more or less in a, you know, kind of a, almost a dream state of them saying we've been misunderstood.
Yeah.
Because really, when you, if we never had seen Jaws, I mean, the beautiful part about the Santa Barbara connection was Tim Bottoms was offered that role for Richard Dreyfuss.
Yeah, I heard about that, and he turned it down.
And he turned it down because he didn't like the stigma that it was going to put towards sharks.
Yeah.
Because they're essential in our ecosystem. Yeah. We have healthy coral reefs because of sharks. If you don't see sharks on coral reefs, then you won't have a healthy ecosystem.
Yeah.
They need to be there.
You know, it's interesting how that mentality seems to pervade even our human connection with one another. I'm noticing in what seems to be now going on 3 years, this very tumultuous political arena that we live in these days in the United States, where, and this is just my observation, and it's probably totally wrong, but I'm picking up on it. Both sides, if you look at the two sides, okay, want the other side to go away, just to disappear, and the world will just be a beautiful place for everyone to live. And yet I have challenged some talk show hosts on both sides saying, well, first of all, there are two things. Number one is, don't you think that you owe the other side a gratitude of thanks, because without them, you'd have nothing to talk about on the radio? And two, don't you think you're partly responsible for the problems you say they're responsible for because you didn't get the people out on your side to vote to make sure the right people got into these offices to make the changes that would make the world a beautiful place? And again, I'm being extremely facetious here. Mm-hmm. And yet at the same time, I'm trying to make a point. We're all here together. I use this analogy when you talk about our connectedness, not only to the plants and the animals, but to one another as human beings. If the good Lord, or whatever term you wish to use, had intended for us to live solitary lives, there, I'm sure, there are sufficient M-class planets that we each could have our own. But the reality is, 7.5 or 8 billion strong, we're all here.
I know.
And that tells me that we're all supposed to work together.
Mm-hmm.
And what is truly saddening and maddening is it's only in times of crises that we come together, whether it be natural disasters or otherwise, that the people will come together, they'll protect people they don't even know, they'll help people they don't even know, they don't know what their economic status is, their political affiliations, their religious connections, they don't know any of that. Yet they'll help them in those times. Where in the heck are they when we're not in crisis?
Well, I think that's when people are waking up, right? If I, back to the conscious and unconscious
mm-hmm,
breathers,
mm-hmm.
Why do people exercise? Why do people do yoga? Why do people, because they want to be more conscious. See, if we're only accessing 20 out of our 64 codes, which science say, and even some new scientists say that, oh, if we have all these extra codes, maybe we don't need them. I think we do need them. You're right? I mean, we need
them. I'm not using my left ear or my right ear anymore, so I don't need that. Just take it off.
Yeah, I mean, it's essential because the 64 codes actually match a lot of things in nature. It's our connectivity. So back to those wave patterns. If we're using anger and fear with one another, we don't access our DNA matrix. When we use love, compassion,
mm-hmm.
So DNA specialists have shown those wave patterns touching our DNAs. So we're accessing more DNA when we're kinder, when we're loving.
Yeah.
In fact, when you think about it, when you're so frustrated, guess what term you use? Remember how important words are?
Uh-huh.
I can't think straight, right? You feel like all the mechanisms have crisscrossed,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
and you just get that blank, right? Or you just like...
You kind of stare off into space.
So frustrated. It's because you're not accessing the DNA,
yeah.
right? The DNA matrix. The more access we have to our DNA, the more awareness we have, the more awareness we have, the more compassion and love we're able to have.
Yeah.
So it's really it starts with our breath, because if we want to be conscious about something, say you do an action and then it creates a ripple effect, right? But then later on you said, I wasn't aware that my action would have caused that, right?
Yeah.
It's the same kind of awareness. I wasn't aware. But the minute we're aware that our action creates that ripple, then we have a consciousness about it, which in turn, if no one's ever been homeless, they wouldn't know what that feels like.
Don't have points of reference.
Right? They wouldn't have. But the minute you have been homeless, like I went through a horrific year of having my life threatened and being homeless and losing stuff. And people make generalizations.
Mm-hmm.
Like people have a perception about homelessness. They think it's a certain type of person that gets home. No, we're all like a threat away. If we don't have friends to help us, if we have an illness, if we lose one thing and then it snowballs, then where do you go?
Yeah.
You're out on the street.
Hurricane
right?
rolls through your neighborhood and destroys every house on the block, including yours. Where are you going to live?
Yeah.
What are you going to do? You're now homeless.
I know. Unless you have friends reaching out for you, and trying to help. So it's to have compassion, to see someone on the side of the road and what we make a judgment about them. Mm-hmm. A lot of times we're so busy judging that we forget that we could easily be them.
Yeah.
And when you were making one point about how easy it is for people to take opposing sides to one another.
Yeah.
During the time of the election, I was in the ocean when some dolphins swam by, and one of them passed the leaf to me. Right? They have a leaf game that they play in the water. And in that passing of the leaf, they basically said, you are to pass the leaf of peace to one another. Not so much me, but humanity as a whole.
Mm-hmm.
We are
mm-hmm.
to reach out to one another like indigenous tribes used to do with the feather. We are to say, this is how I honor you. This is what we have in common. I might not agree with the way you are or living, but we have more in common than we have imposed.
Yeah.
Right? Mm-hmm. And I could easily be in your shoes given different circumstances.
Yeah, exactly.
So, I mean, with dolphins, I was kind of mentioning to Ed, the other radio host, that in their world, the leaf game, you don't steal the leaf. You wait till it's passed to you.
Yeah.
And I think humans as a whole, we need to wait to not so much wait, but offer a leaf, even if we don't. You know, I think of circumstances with people who have been not very nice to me and where I've bent over backwards to try to make amends or, you know, they're trying to blame me for things in their own life. And if I respond back in the same kind of energy that they've been giving me, how does that, it's like...
Doesn't change anything.
Fire with fire, right?
Exactly.
I'm supposed to respond back with water.
Exactly.
Is how do you put out fire, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I need to offer my leaf of peace by saying, I'm sorry that you're hurting. And I hope you get better. And this is, I am happy for this opportunity. I mean, of course I feel hurt inside. Of course it bothers me.
Sure.
But to rant back to them, instead I said, this gives me an opportunity to forgive you, right? Because what they're doing is unconscious, right? They're not conscious about the fact that their words are daggers, and they're trying to, stab me.
I sort of, argue the same point when it comes to politics and campaigns, and it doesn't matter what campaign we're talking about. I mean, I go back to some of the campaigns of the 70s as a kid, just barely consciously aware of what was actually going on.
Mm.
And, and I've even talked with politicians and I say, how can you say the kinds of things, or how can that person, we're having a dialogue and he hasn't been this way, but this person over here has been saying these awful things about this other person running for the same office. And whether they're true or not, and then of course the person throwing the epithets and what have you wins, and then they move on and they all join hands and sing kumbaya. Now let's go beat the other guys and move to the next level and so forth. And they say, oh, no, it's only politics. And I say, no, it's not. Because the intent of that language was to achieve a specific result. And the result was to win that election. So there was intent behind those words. Mm. Those words had power.
Yes.
And when I was working for, I worked for 15 years in the 80s and early 90s for a Christian radio station. And that's really where I began to develop the philosophy of the power of words as far as my life was concerned, because they kept talking about the power of the word, you know, and so forth. And I thought, well, okay, yes, I get what you're saying,
but
the power of words.
A word is alive.
A word is alive. It has energy. You give it intent. You give it energy. And it's coming from the heart, okay?
That's why prayer is so powerful.
Exactly.
People think, oh, prayer is some airy-fairy thing. No, because the same intention that you use to say, oh, I really wish I had that car, or I really wish I had, right? That's intention. That's a drive. That's motivated with emotion.
Yeah.
Feeling, you know, feelings and emotion are the same. And
yeah.
thoughts,
yeah.
right? Well, you switch that over to prayer, someone sick that you love. It's generated by the same stuff.
Yeah.
All those feelings with words.
Yeah.
And so it has power.
It really does. And and I'm hoping people start to understand that, because the things that we say, you know, and I hear also, I hear people saying, well, I'm tired of political correctness. All right, go ahead. Be tired of political correctness. But could you be kind and civil and tactful? That's not political correctness. That's just common human decency.
Yeah.
That's just us being able to disagree. You're over on the left. I'm over on the right. But we, as you said earlier, we have more in common than we have not in common.
Well, just back down to our breath, right?
Yeah.
In the same room.
We're both breathing the same.
Yeah.
You're not breathing the air on the left, and I'm breathing the air on the right. We're breathing the same air in the same room.
And I'm breathing.
Give me those molecules right now.
And I'm breathing the air that's from Japan.
Yeah.
Or, you know, someone that's living out in the desert, or from an animal. That's why our kindness goes a lot further than anything else.
Yeah.
Right? So it's kind of like.
Yeah. I went through a number of personal growth programs in the 80s and early 90s with my first wife. And it was there that it really was hammered home about the power of words. Mm. We were traveling back to the session one evening, late afternoon on the freeway, and this car went flying by us. And I just had this thought, what an idiot. I wasn't necessarily saying, I hope that guy has a wreck. But it was like, what an idiot. He's flying down the freeway and there's no cops anywhere to catch this guy. Da, 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 da. 3 miles down the road, we passed and there were emergency vehicles and that car crashed. Now, whether or not the intent of my thoughts, let alone words, had caused that, that was impactful to me. And it said whether or not I was directly or even indirectly responsible, that is something I've got to be careful of. And so then I moved to California 11 years, 12 years ago, and I began to experience the kind of driving that I've experienced. And about 3 or 4 years into my stay here, my blood pressure started going up because I started allowing the behavior of other people impacting my own behavior.
Yeah.
Not so much behavior, but my mental state. Mm-hmm. And I remember going to the doctor and they drew all the fluids that were to be drawn from the human body for testing, could not find a cause. I said, you won't. I could have told you that before you did that. It's not up there. It's in here. I need therapy, which is part of what this program is about. But yeah, words, they have so much power.
I saw that when I was a child because I was teased a lot for being overweight and shy, and I slurred my words.
Yeah.
And there was some neighbors at my grandparents' house. So my grandfather built this beautiful rope swing from the big tree, and there was and the neighbor, the one older, she was probably 5 or 6 years older than me. Well, she used to tease me really bad, and she wouldn't get off our swing, right? And I kept on waiting and waiting for my turn to swing. She shouldn't even been in my grandparents' yard, but she was, and she was a bully. And so I looked at her in the face, This is when I was shy, you know, so mm-hmm. when things came out of my mouth. But it was, I think, all the hurt. I said, I hope that rope breaks, right? That's what I said to her. It was a super thick, you know, one of those twisted ropes.
Yeah, multi-twine, right? Mm-hmm.
And within like 10 seconds, that rope snapped and she hit the ground. So, of course, she wanted to kill me, right? I ran inside to hide with my grandparents. But I saw then that especially the emotion of, because I was so tired of her bullying me and she wouldn't get off the swing, that I said that. And that's how powerful words are, right? I don't know if it was the timing of something, but I was like, ooh, I got to watch my words.
I mean, hey, that rope could have already been frayed and on. You could come up with all kinds of other explanations. But the fact that you said it right then, and like you say, 10 seconds later, first of all, I will tell you, I do not believe in coincidence. I believe in coincidence, things that happen at the same time for a reason.
Oh, I believe that too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I just mispronounce it.
No, I think it's lovely because I think that, you know, that's how we can try to – I'm not perfect with my dialogue. I always have to give myself a pep talk and make myself – if I'm super stressed out, I have to go, okay, attitude of gratitude. What am I thankful for? Yeah. And start saying, even if I don't know what I'm thankful for, I'm thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you. To do that, and then that calms me down.
Yeah.
Because I have to say there are – so I'm in yoga this morning, right? Because I'd gone to the dentist yesterday for 2 hours and I was all like – feeling a little wonky. So I went in there and I, you know, how everyone feng shuis their mat so everyone has a little bit of space so you're not like hitting into.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, of course, right after we start, and it's happened more than often, there's space everywhere else. But for whatever reason, someone wants to plop their mat right next to where the feng shui energy is.
Yeah.
Right? Like, so I'm going to hit them if I put my arm up. You know, so number one, you're late. Number two, you're squishing me. Number three, another person came and squished me. So two people were squishing.
Yeah.
And I just, I opened my eyes because we had our eyes closed. The teacher looked at me and she winked. And she goes, it's just yoga. And I just started laughing. And I'm like, she's right. It's just yoga. Like in the big scheme of things, who bloody cares?
Yeah.
Like, I mean, and so I let myself just be free in the music.
Yeah.
So back to... when I say holographic you know, holographic communication,
right?
We've created as humans ways to waves. I'm using the word wave, like an ocean wave, waves to actually make those patterns of holographic communication.
Right.
They're fractals, like an ocean wave, repeating patterns. And we've done it in music. So when I went back to learn storytelling and acting and all the film work and everything in Nashville, I was away from the ocean.
Yeah.
But because I immersed myself in the music world, music was my sea.
Yeah.
Because of those wave patterns. Yeah. They're holographic. And they touch people because music touches us and inspires feelings because they're activating memories in our cells.
Yeah. And something else, too, that also helps me to get through some of these stories that I see and hear is that in the grand scheme of things, our existence as human beings on this planet, I don't just necessarily mean our lives, yours and mine, but I'm talking about all of humanity.
Mm-hmm.
In the grand scheme of things, in the infinity of time in the universe, it's less than a puff of smoke. And that in 1,000 or 10,000 or 100,000 years from now, everything that's going on today, not going to matter. Nobody's even going to know about it. Nobody's going to care. It's irrelevant. And so living in the moment here now, why not?
Yes, and we also have to, I mean, some people can use that way of thinking and say, then why should I even care, right? Why do I even, if I don't matter, why should I make an effort to care?
Except for one thing. I never said we didn't matter.
Yeah.
I said in the grand scheme of things, I know where you're going with this.
No, but because my work about using the dolphin communication is why we matter.
Exactly.
It's like, I want to talk about why we matter, down to ourselves, down to our memories, down to leaving a legacy, down to each choice that we make in our life, you know?
Now,
so.
And your book, your first book is I Am Dolphin.
No, the first book is Dolphin Talk.
Dolphin Talk.
And available on Amazon Kindle. It's called Dolphin Talk,
Oh, that's right. I saw that.
How we can talk with dolphins in 5 easy steps. And most people just kind of like laugh like, oh, that's not even real. Right? I wrote it because it was the first time I actually wrote, you know, because people were asking, how can I talk with an animal? You know, how can I talk with my dog? And I'm like, maybe I should try to write this down. Because I was doing it as second nature. Mm-hmm. It was part of my nature to talk with animals.
It just was.
Because it was part of my, yeah, it was part of my healing.
Yeah.
Right? It was part of like what saved me, mm-hmm. you know, like growing up. And it became my compass in life. It became my almost like search for the Holy Grail was reconnecting with nature, my nature, our nature and nature. That became, and communicating with dolphins and animals. Because I've talked with a number of animals, not just dolphins, like snakes and horses and dogs and cats. And
So before we run out of time, I want to know about I Am Dolphin. It's the Beneath the Waves of Holographic Communication. It's a series by Dolphin Girl, you, Dove Jones. Tell me about that.
Okay, so after I published that book, a couple days later, I met this acoustic scientist who actually showed me those mandala images.
Mm.
It was exactly what I tried describing in my book about talking with animals, right? And that, so I brought in a little bit of science in the Dolphin Talk book. And then I was so excited. I'm like, oh my God, here is physical proof. So Buckminster Fuller, how cool he was he was a mathematician. He was also a quantum physics scientist. And he said dolphins may be carrying information and functions critical to the regeneration of life upon our planet. But he didn't have the proof.
Wow.
Yes, I know, mouthful.
Yeah.
Well, what I wrote in my book, those images actually prove what he was postulating on. And that is, they are doing regeneration. And when we are exposed to holographic sound, this has been measured from scientists, we start emulating that sound. Why it's so important, why we are gravitate towards art, why we gravitate towards music, because those wave patterns affect us. They allow us to access different parts of our DNA and our memory and our cell memories. Each of our cells, we have 70 trillion cells in each body. Each of us are walking around with these 70 trillion cells. Around each cell of those 70 trillion, we have 10 molecules of water.
Mm.
How we're able to communicate, how you and I talk, we first talk through our cells of water. That's how I talk to a plant, you know, an animal. We're communicating always through the water channels. In Aboriginal language, that would be called the song lines.
Mm.
Channels of energy
patterns.
Yeah, so I Am Dolphin is really the scientific evidence supporting that type of communication, which is actually an invisible realm. So how to put it into words? It took me combining 7 different sciences, music, and the language of silence to talk about holographic communication.
Mm.
So
give me a website where people can get more information about all of this. This is utterly fascinating.
Thank you. You can go to dolphingirl.org or iamdolphin.com.
Okay. They both go to the same place.
They both go to the same place.
Okay.
Even if someone Googled dovejones.com, it will now direct you over to dolphingirl.org.
Okay.
Because I just put everything in there.
I want to thank you so much for sharing your story and the information and being here in studio with us today. This has just been utterly fascinating. And before we let you go, I have 3 final questions for you that I ask all of my guests. And again, much appreciation for the work that you're doing. If we would only listen, and that's the key right now. It's the information's out there. It's available. And obviously through Tell Me Your Story, we're going to spread the word. I'd love to see us change the ways in which we're doing things and interacting with one another as human beings, let alone with the animals and the plants on the planet as well. So the first question I have for you is, who is Dove Jones?
Who is me? I'm an evolution. I'm like I put this on Facebook. I'm like a child. I'm the stars. I'm the ocean. I'm an ocean wave. I feel like I'm evolving and changing. Who I think I am, I change from that, right? So I'm in motion. I don't know how else. I mean, I could say I am a dolphin, probably my essence is like that. My 100-year-old grandmother said, she looked at me and she says, I know why what you're doing. She said, you're doing this so people will become more like a dolphin. And I mean, that's really the essence. So people learn how to, you know, to put the humane back into the word humanity. So I don't know, you know, maybe. So I just feel like the essence of me is like an ocean wave. I guess that's who I am.
What is it that you hope to or want to achieve through the work that you're doing now?
I want to achieve ripples of love and peace and smiles. I want people to be happy, because when you're happy, then you don't want to hurt others.
And finally, what is your life's purpose?
My purpose, I call my purpose in life. So I think it's just that. It's to spread, you know, the dolphin smile with people. So people remember who they are, remember their nature with nature, and that we're more than who we think we are. We kind of sometimes put ourselves in captivity in the way that we think, and we all want to be wild and free. I think when John Denver was speaking about that, I got to meet him in person, which was a really beautiful thing. At a time, really sensitive time in his life, when a lot of people were wanting a piece of him, and he was so sensitive and so kind. And I think that when he was saying we need to be wild and free, it's like all you have to do is think about Noah's Ark. Why did God, in that story, right, only want everyone on in that ark to be all the pairs of animals and only a few humans? It's like they're meant to be our helpmates for a reason.
Yeah.
And, you know, and so when I think about the wild and free, it's like all of our essence of each person on this planet wants to feel like they have a sense of freedom, wants to feel like that their heart is happy in a way that's like without the restrictions, right? And so, you know, I hope that for everyone, the wild and free.
And it just dawned on me in that story that the human race originally started with Adam and Eve, according to that story. Then we had the flood that took out every human being except for that family, which means that the human race was then restarted by a select few people, which is rather interesting if you think about it. But we won't go there. That's for another show. Dev Jones, thank you so much for joining us here on the program.
It's been a pleasure.
I'm Richard Dugan. This has been Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. We're giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. Until next time, love to Lal.
Crystal clear ocean, to ride on the crest of a wild raging storm. To work in the service of life and the living, in search of the answers to questions unknown. To be part of the movement, part of the growing, part of beginning to understand. So the places you've been to, the things that you've shown us, the stories you tell, I could, so I sing to your spirit, the men who have served you so long and so well. I am a love, I am a love. Like the dolphin who guides you, you bring us beside you, light up the darkness and show us the way. For though we are strangers in your silent world, to live on the land we must learn from the sea. To be true as the tide, and free as a wind swell, joyful and loving in letting it be.